Welcome to MoFo Perspectives, a podcast by Morrison Forster, where we share the perspectives of our clients, colleagues, subject matter experts, and lawyers.
Good morning, everybody. This is Suze McCormick. I'm a partner at MoFo, where I've been for more than 25 years. We thought we would start 2024 with a discussion really featuring BSR and Aaron to really talk about the state of play for ESG today, where we've come from the last year or two, which have been fraught, and where we're headed. And just to give you some perspective, we started this series really to feature BSR because for those of you who don't know, Business for Social Responsibility has been doing this work for more than 30 years. So actually, in fact, BSR was doing this work long before it was called ESG, and will be doing this work long after it's no longer called ESG, depending on what happens with the terminology. Those of you who know me know the term ESG was coined in 2004 in a United Nations report that was actually put together by a bunch of institutional investors. And the general thesis behind it was these are a whole bunch of environmental, social, and governance factors that tie to shareholder value and profitability for companies, but are not necessarily on the balance sheet. And 2004 was also a time, and we're going to come to this in the program today, before there was legislation, before this was put into the compliance bucket. And we'll talk about compliance being one element of this. But quite frankly, even though I'm the lawyer on the call, it's less than half of it. ESG started 2004, came out, got merged with a whole bunch of other things, and now, quite frankly, is being attacked by both the left and the right for all kinds of reasons. So the terminology has become fraught. So I wanted to start this program really teeing it up for Aaron to tell us how we got, you were BSR, but you specifically were one of the leaders in the space before it was ESG. Tell us how we got here, Aaron.
Thank you, Suze. And thanks everyone for joining. Suze, you're very generous and also very modest because you have equally been an important leader in shaping how companies think about all of this and act on it. Let's take on the three letters ESG. And I'd like to say, before getting into a little bit of how we got here, I think we can say ESG is dead, long live ESG, as in the term may not work for a number of people for a whole variety of reasons, but the core concept that is embodied in ESG, which you described very well, Suze, environmental, social, and governance issues that are relevant to business and relevant to society, those exist irrespective of whether some people are going after the terminology. And you see it in a thousand different ways, whether it's having effective boards who understand how the world is changing, whether it's dealing with the direct business impacts of climate, whether it's considering if you're a mining company, what is the human rights and community context in which you're operating so that you can operate. Those are things that the labels don't really help. Those are things that are important, have been important, and will be important. So how did we get here? I really think it's that there's been a rising recognition that a lot of these questions are very directly relevant for business and answer a core question that the average person on the street, not someone who works for an ESG index, not a chief sustainability officer, is a company living up to expectations? Is a company behaving fairly? Is a company respecting communities, respecting the environment? That's what the average person wants to know. And companies, I think, increasingly can be rewarded for that. They can also be punished for that. Where we've come to is, I'd say, a much more mature understanding of all of this. When BSR got started in 1992, I think a lot of the dialogue was, this is the right thing to do. This is important to think about. Stakeholders care. And all of that's true. There's no doubt about it. But the level of understanding that you see in boardrooms, in C-suites, and frankly, people on the front lines for companies in all sorts of different roles, there is a maturity in all of this, and we shouldn't lose sight of it. I think there's maybe a more positive version of the story of the boiling frog, which suddenly finds itself in trouble. In fact, if you take out the day-to-day vicissitudes, the variations that you see, the debates, the headlines, all of that, I think it is undeniable that companies understand the importance of this and have gotten significantly more sophisticated with respect to understanding the role that, let's say, just and sustainable business plays in how they lead their companies, how they steward their companies, how they make investments, how they think about innovation, how they engage with the outside world, how they engage in partnerships, all of that. So I think we faced so much volatility. The 2020s were defined, including by BSR, as the decisive decade. They've been arguably the indecisive decade, the 2020s, but I think more the a volatile decade. And if you take out that volatility and look at the trend lines, the progress is undeniable. Got a long ways to go, but the progress is undeniable and the level of maturity is significantly higher than previously.
That's true. And it was interesting. I got, when we sent out this blast, you invited, and we invited a lot of our clients who were on to the podcast, I got a couple of emails like, oh, Suze, ESG is dead. Oh, Suze, are you jumping on the bandwagon? I'm like, interestingly, we're not focusing on ESG anymore. And I'm like, actually, everybody's focusing on ESG. Blackstone, long before this was a term, again, put it all under governance. Every investor understands the interplay between governance and valuation. Every company understands the importance of governance being the scaffolding around businesses. And if you go to the term, in addition to climate and DEI, which we're going to come to, ESG as a term has always included cybersecurity since it was coined, has always included privacy, has always included anti-money laundering, anti-bribery, and all of those. And when we get in a minute to the sort of the regulatory, the interesting thing to me is the new regulation and compliance and then good governance around this area involves thinking about not just your business, but the business of your suppliers, the business of your customers, all of the other stakeholders, and that's being embedded within the regulations. When you have state laws that are like, you can't talk about ESG, what we're finding is the asset managers taking money from those pensions are just saying, it's not ESG, it's just climate risk and cyber. They're just naming the elements, which is, I think, why you said ESG is dead, long live ESG. We at the firm are moving to ESG and sustainability, which I find ironic because the group was first called the sustainability group back in 2001, but my partners didn't know what that was. So I feel like we're coming all the way full circle. But there, before we go on to the broader picture, I'd like you to talk about recently where ESG is on the global stage. And you were both at COP and at Davos. Aaron, can you tell us, maybe start with COP and then take us to Davos in terms of what are some of your reflections on this area from those convenings?
Yeah, and I would even add Climate Week in September. So you've had these three massive global gatherings in a four-month period of time, which you can debate whether we need that much. But regardless, I think it is reflective with this of the state of play. First of all, I will start with COP. And I think there was so much debate over COP. And I think COPs have to be judged fairly. To get a consensus amongst 195 countries with very different circumstances and interests and levels of influence, it is a massive and massively difficult task. Al Gore is calling for the reform of the COP process because consensus amongst 195 countries is so hard. So you can say for some advocates and for some businesses as well, the language in the final agreement was not strong enough. Transition away from fossil fuels. A lot of people, including BSR and a coalition that we're part of, the We Mean Business Coalition, we wanted to see the phase out language. But the fact is, and just look at some of the geopolitical debates that are out there, the fact that an agreement came together at all with a degree of clarity, it is a massive achievement and something that is really not happening in almost any other context in the world right now. So I think it's important to take a step back and understand that and say that that direction is important. So that's one. Two other things on COP. One is there is a ton to play for between now and COP 30 in Brazil towards the end of next year. That is when all the countries, and let's hope the United States remains a party to COP in 2025, have to put their new nationally determined contributions. This will be crucial. This will be absolutely crucial. And so while COP 29 will be important, actually, we really, I think, eyes on the prize for next year in Brazil. And business has a role to play to continue to encourage governments to exhibit ambition in their plans. The third thing I would say is business showed up in a stunningly big way in COP. I've gone to, I think, five COPs now. This one was twice as big as any other prior COP. Businesses were there in very large numbers. And I think that speaks to the degree that some people might conclude that the backlash that's out there is diminishing business commitment. I think COP was a loud statement to the contrary. So those are three things I'd take away from COP. In terms of Davos, and by the way, COP ruined my Thanksgiving and Davos ruined my Christmas, New Year's holiday. So these things need to be scheduled differently. I'd say good news, bad news from Davos, which was just last week. On the formal program at the World Economic Forum, climate and other elements of sustainability, including DEI, were less visible. There were simply fewer sessions on these topics than in the past 3 or 4 years. Davos took 2021 off and 2022 was a semi-Davos. That's not great, but I think if you look at the side events, if you haven't been to Davos, there's the formal program that the World Economic Forum puts on. But then, like a lot of these events, it's what's happening on the sidelines that's really indicative of where people are. And they're everything from direct air capture to climate finance to climate and nature to the just transition. Lots of discussions about DEI, lots of discussions about the societal implications of AI, to be sure. Those were all very visible with very vigorous debates and, frankly, business and geopolitics, and I hope we'll come to that later. If I look at where these things are now compared to where they used to be, it's light years ahead. I first went to Davos in 2005. There were, I believe, six of us who could speak a couple of coherent sentences about sustainable business in 2005. I really felt like we were subversive agents infiltrating this event. Now it's fundamentally different, and any CEO that you'll meet is going to have something useful to say about all of the topics that we're talking about today. We should not lose sight of that. I'm an optimist by nature. I think there are a lot of reasons to be pessimistic, but let's not lose sight of the fact that the state of play is fundamentally different than it used to be. And I think that's been on display both at COP and in Davos.
No, I agree. It's interesting to me. I'll give my two cents. I was at Climate Week. I was a little discouraged. I do want to say in this area, I think a lot of people feel like we have won because everybody's in the room and everybody is talking, which is great. But I went to the first Climate Week and now this, and if you actually look at the trajectory of emissions, we're getting worse and worse. COP, it was interesting to me. I was at, I think, the fourth COP. And then this year I got out of offices from partners at other firms who couldn't smell climate change 5 years ago, and they were all there as well. So I actually take that as a really good sign that people are taking it seriously. The question is, and we'll come to this, what is actually going to move the needle? And before we go, just to give people the agenda for the rest, we're going to talk a little bit about compliance and the new regulation, what's there and what's coming in this area. Then we're going to go over to Aaron to talk about how business is really adapting to this. We're going to do a deeper dive on where we are on some of the specific issues like responsible tech, like cyber, like climate DEI. And then we're going to look ahead and give you our thoughts for 2024. But as we are doing that, I have the chat open. This should be a dialogue. So if you have any questions, I was looking at my phone. I've already gotten texts from a few people who are on this. And I know you guys know a lot about this area. And for those who don't, you have basic questions, whatever the question, there are no bad questions. Just please put it in the chat and we will weave it in. So the interesting thing to me as a lawyer about this area is when I started focusing back in 2001, there was very little hard law. So it was interesting to me. You had the environmental regulatory folks over here, and then corporate folks weren't paying any attention. There was some environmental regulation obviously affecting climate, and there was some regulation related to anti-money laundering. And there has been a sea change. I will say, before I give you an overview of the regulatory landscape, I will say, if you just use the regulations as a benchmark, as a company or an investor, you're going to be in really bad shape. And the reason is, and we'll talk a little bit about the coming litigation, companies and investors have been focusing in this area for 20 years. So there's a whole bunch that you're doing and have been disclosing before there's regulation, and you need to factor that in. You can't just say, okay, let's leave all the voluntary disclosure behind and have it because it was made to investors and consumers and look anew because now we have regulation that's telling us exactly how we need to measure and report on our carbon emissions. So you have to look at what came before, and you also have to look at what's coming. And I will just preview this by saying 120 regulators around the world have said that they are going to be following the ISSB, the International Sustainability Standards Board, which is under the IFRS, in terms of passing regulation about what companies say and disclose to investors about their ESG. So that's 120, that's almost all the majority of countries where there is significant commerce around the world. The answer for companies and investors is you may not care, but you're going to care because there's going to be regulation. And then we're going to get to, you should care because it's going to impact your profitability and your ability to have an ability to operate and a license to operate, which Aaron is going to go into just really quickly. And obviously, if you guys want to have further information on any of this regulation, we're happy to provide. Because I'm a U.S. lawyer, I do not think the U.S. is the leader here, but I start in the U.S. because that's what I know best. So you've got a whole bunch of things, and FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, publishing and promulgating green guides to update what companies say to consumers. You've got the SEC, which is starting to regulate even more and has a huge enforcement division on cyber, on names, and coming on climate about what companies say and disclose around ESG and particularly climate. You've got state developments in the United States, particularly California. And for those of you who don't know, there are three pieces of legislation related to climate that came out in California at the end of last year: emissions, risk, and disclosure. And the disclosure piece was meant to provide some transparency for the voluntary credit markets, but it's much broader to encompass any company, public, private, doing business in California that is making statements about its climate goals, very wide reaching. I think the jury's out on how much impact they'll have actually on climate. So you've got states that are getting in the action. You've got state attorney generals that are getting into the action, both sides, pro and con, attacking companies for being too green, attacking companies for not being green enough. And then I talked about the international. You've got the EU is a game changer with CSRD, with SFDR. The compliance in terms of disclosure goes into effect in 2025, which means that those large issuers are starting to gather data for reporting now. Why this matters for every U.S. company is because we're going to get to it in the specific areas, whether it's human rights, AI, or climate, or cyber. All of this regulation requires that you report not only on what you are doing, but what all of your counterparties are doing as well. So if you are a small U.S. company in the Valley and you've got a battery company and you're going to have a contract with VW, you're going to need to know what they need to report because you're going to be reporting to them, which is why this is such a broad base. I often say it doesn't matter what the SEC does because you've got the bookends of California and the EU affecting everybody and every company in the U.S. That's not true. It does matter. And we'll get in a minute to the cyber rules and the climate rules, which we do expect this year, probably before the election from the SEC, which will be game changers. But that's the lay of the land. But I want to turn it back to Aaron, because I really think, and again, I'm just a lawyer, but if you just focus on compliance, you're screwed as an investor or as a company. Aaron, can you tease out that perspective and talk about how companies should be adapting and what they should be looking at and doing, especially at the leadership level, in addition to compliance?
Yeah, thanks for that excellent overview, Suze. We are at BSR, we're focusing a lot of time and attention on this because our members are. And the point of view is that this is a really positive development, and there are some potential unintended consequences that are really important to call out as well. Simply put, compliance is raising the floor for not only reporting and disclosure, but also performance. The risk is that it lowers the ceiling of ambition. And so that's important for companies to attend to. So that's one potential unintended consequence. The other is, let's face it, no company has ever complied its way into innovation, into collaboration, into, you know, capital allocation for things that are most important. And it is essential, obviously, that companies pay close attention to this new regulatory or these multiple regulatory frameworks that are emerging. But you can't stop there. And quite frankly, we've seen some warning signs that companies, boards, and C-suites, their mind share is very much on compliance as opposed to performance and ambition, and resources also are being dedicated there. We have had a number of chief sustainability officers say to us, sometimes in direct language, sometimes not, this isn't what I signed up for. I have become a compliance officer. No disrespect to compliance officers. This is really important. But sustainability at the end of the day is about prospective activity. Reporting and disclosure is about retrospective activity. And if companies focus too much time and attention on measuring what happened last year, they will not be doing enough to shape what will happen next year, next decade, on topics that are changing very rapidly. So I think that contextual point is supremely important. The other thing that companies can do is there is an immense drive, and it's really important for, you can say convergence, you can say interoperability of the various standards, because yes, the EU is de facto the standard that a lot of companies are going to be using, but there are a lot of different frameworks and it's very complicated, and companies can and should be using their voice, whether publicly or privately, almost doesn't matter, to push for harmonization. And that's been happening, although I would say imperfectly, for example, with the SEC on the climate disclosure rules, where some companies have been saying, look, go for it. We see where this is all heading. We want the rules in the U.S. to be consistent with other major economies around the world. There are other companies, frankly, that are saying, let's try to lower the bar as much as we can in the United States and carve out some space for us to do less in this area. Even if you don't believe in ambition, ultimately, I think that's counterproductive because it will create more noise in the system than companies want. Consistency, clarity, predictability is a business virtue, and we need it on regulation. And you can't wish away the European Union. It's as simple as that.
That's right. It's interesting to me. The other thing I'll just say, importance, of course, you need compliance. However, one of the things I noticed is after CSRD passed, the accounting firms went to all the Fortune 500 and said, now you need to spend millions and millions of dollars because you need to measure all this stuff with a double materiality lens in addition to a single materiality lens. Fast forward, I'll get my dates wrong. 6 months later, they have implementing rules that say, hey, you actually can use a single materiality lens. There's a lot of negotiation of that. What I worry about is all of the work that all those companies are doing with the double materiality and the millions of dollars that they're going to spend. A, they're not going to be grandfathered in when the EU rules change, and the EU rules are going to change. And B, you spend all of this money on compliance, but you actually haven't advanced the ball. There is more of a disconnect between what you are doing and the value of your company than before. This is what Aaron is saying. Looking at it from the business lens, I would just pause before somebody comes to you. And Aaron and I have both been as Aaron longer than me, a long time. There are 100 consultants telling you have to do 100 things and it's going to cost $5 million. No. From a compliance perspective, no. Just pause and say, what do we need to do now? And let's look at how the regulation evolves, because as Aaron said, it is changing. Most jurisdictions are, again, following S1 and S2 under ISSB, so they're a good benchmark, but they're all a little different. I'm wonky enough to review the Hong Kong rules or to review the rule, and most of them are steering towards a single materiality standard. What does that mean? So single materiality is the standard the SEC rules say, which is you as a company, you need to be focused on shareholder value and economic value. And so you screen these ESG factors and specifically focus on the impact that they have on shareholders. So that doesn't mean you don't consider stakeholders. It means that where you focus is on what is driving the economics, is driving shareholder value, which is was the original definition of ESG in the first place. And we've gotten all muddled. But Aaron, you want to say anything?
Yeah. On that, look, I think when it comes to following the disclosure rules, single materiality may play. It's going to be evolving over the next several years. When it comes to doing the right thing for your company, failing to look at impacts on society will give you only a partial picture of things. And so I think it is important, therefore, to look at double materiality, because otherwise there will be an undiscovered country, if you will, that people may not see and understand. Because I think if you look at the other rationale for that, in my view, is that impacts on society today may be impacts on business tomorrow. And there's a long history over the whole history of BSR, where we've seen that happen, where stakeholder views, even if they're extraneous to business, can be a proxy for understanding what is going to become much more material for shareholders, and let alone for business strategy. So I think both things are really important. How you frame it for compliance reasons may be different. Going through life only opening one eye is not really a good way to go, in my view.
100% agree. And my point is, just don't view double materiality just with the compliance lens, with the accountants.
Right.
That's a business proposition. And in just a second, we're going to get to responsible tech, ethical AI, key example of considering stakeholders and shareholders, because it's the right thing to do. You really don't want to further blow up democracy. But even more importantly, it's going to affect equally importantly, it's going to affect the value of your company going forward. So that's exactly Aaron's point. What I'm saying is shift that to the business. And one of the interesting things, I'm going to talk a little bit about litigation that we've had. We work with corporate counsel and have for a number of years, and going out to hundreds of in-house counsel, public and private companies. 5 years ago, they might have had somebody, especially at some of the advanced companies that understood what ESG and sustainability were, but generally your general rank and file in-house lawyer was not thinking about it. Now, most of them are. There has been a sea shift. Some of it has been compliance. Some of it is because this impacts supply chains. Some of it is because the companies have made commitments around net zero and carbon neutral and DEI that filter all the way through. But the vast majority, it's up to, you know, more than 90% of in-house counsel now say ESG is part of their purview, whether they're licensing, compliance, litigation, wherever they are, corporate, which is very interesting. And in the survey we did last year, 80% of in-house counsel said that, in fact, they were starting to tie compensation at their companies to ESG factors. I think there's a lot of room for improvement there in terms of using the variables, using comp as a tool. It is really hard. And I know BSR was at the cutting edge of this. And there are folks I'll just call out like Nike and HP that have been doing this for 10, 15 years. So they know what works. But I think it's an interesting trend. And Aaron, you want to comment on that? And then I want to talk a little bit, another reason why in-house counsel are focused is because of the rising tide of litigation. But Aaron, anything you want to say before I go to that?
I think you said it well. And I do think clearly more companies are tying executive compensation, at least, to social, environmental, and governance factors. As you say, it's not easy to do well. But the first simplest, and hopefully not simplistic, bit of advice I give is just do what's relevant for your company. It's not going to be the same in every industry sector for every company. And avoid the temptation to rely on the indices. There may be people from the indices on the call. I apologize in advance. But they're all over the map in terms of what they say. And I have seen companies that have tied compensation on ESG to performance in the indices. And it often leads to tears because they can vary substantially year to year, vary substantially based on which indices you use. So those are my two pieces of advice on that. It's not simple. It ain't never going to be perfect, but that doesn't mean you don't do it.
And I'm still waiting for questions to come out of the chat. In the interim, we will keep going, but please do, if you have a question, put it in. So another reason why lawyers are focused on this is because there is now litigation. And at the firm, initially, when I started practicing this area 2001, this was an extension of the corporate practice because we were setting up new corporate forms, we were working on the governance, we were thinking about disclosure, we were thinking about fiduciary duties. We have an ESG and sustainability group that is now more than half litigators. And the reason is because our clients are getting sued, getting threatened with suits, having investigations. And they vary. You have consumers, you have state AGs, you have the US government in the form of antitrust that is looking at this. Climate is not an exception to antitrust when a whole bunch of people get together and want to affect change within their supply chain in an industry. It affects price and supply. There are antitrust issues there that need a lot of support, and shareholders, because companies have in the past and are continuing to make a lot of disclosure in these areas and what they say and how they say. And so we divide the litigation that is outstanding now or has been filed now into, I would say, three buckets. There's a lot of environmental litigation. A lot of it is around climate, in addition to the normal environmental regulatory litigation. I would commend to you the Sabin Center's climate change litigation databases, which really do keep up. And the Sabin Center is at Columbia Law School. I teach at Berkeley, but Columbia is doing an excellent job here. So the climate litigation or NGOs are individual people. If you look at Montana versus Held with the right to a safe environment, are greenwashing. If you look at VCM's greenwashing case against Delta, or state AGs, if you look at California's lawsuit against Big Oil, and relate to consumer, the lawsuit against KLM for misleading advertising on carbon emissions. So we've got that whole body, sort of an extension of environmental into the climate space. You guys know there's a lot of social litigation, particularly in the wake of the Harvard and UNC case with SCOTUS and the state AG is getting into the action. But we as a law firm were sued, and some of our clients have been sued as well, again, on the basis of race. We'll come back to that in a second. And there's a lot of consumer protection, rising tide of consumer protection litigation as well. And I just commend to you AG Tennessee versus BlackRock, which is over false and misleading statements to Tennessee consumers on ESG. So again, the interesting thing about litigation is typically you can see it's coming from one place. This is coming from about 10 different places. And I will end by saying one of the most interesting things on climate I've seen is the individual plaintiffs who are getting standing to sue, the carbon majors being the 100 largest emitters, for individual damages. So say in Pakistan, you've lost a couple trillion dollars, you get standing to bring a cause of action against a cement manufacturer, an ag company, or an oil and gas company that is responsible for 2% or 5% or 0.1% of global emissions. And, you know, 0.1% of 10 trillion is a lot of money. I can't do the math this quickly, but it's a lot of money. On the positive side, one of the things that is driving is a lot of an innovation within the Fortune 500, their BSR is working with a lot of these companies. It actually makes economic sense for their global emissions to go from 2 to 1.8, because that is trillions of dollars of potential liability that they will not have for this litigation. So I don't think litigation is yet driving the decisions in the C-suite. It is certainly one reason that the in-house counsel are focused on this area. And it is certainly something to watch, because when we get to the trends, people are expecting to see a lot more litigation. And one of the reasons is because we've had 20 years before regulation, and now there's regulation. And the simple thing that I explained to people is you were using a voluntary standard and you said your emissions were 10. Now you've got regulation that says you have to be 20. And depending on what assumptions you made in those calculations, you're going out essentially with a restatement to your consumers and your shareholders. And that is going to yield a lot of litigation. Aaron, before we get into the specifics.
Well, yeah, for those of you who may not know, I'm trained as a lawyer. I actually went to work at MOFO after law school, which was a great experience. And the then managing partner, when in the first week, talked about how sometimes you deal with the so-called parade of horribles, all the things that can create headaches. And Suze, you just walked through a lot of things that are headaches. If you zoom out, here's what's going on. What's going on is progress is being made. Let's just take climate. Progress is being made, but it's clearly not enough and it's not fast enough. And so the impacts are piling up, and the tools that groups of citizens or attorneys general or other actors have are being used more and more to hold companies to account. And I think we could have a long and interesting debate over whether, as a matter of social policy, public policy, that's the right way to get after it. But these tools exist, and they're going to be used more and more, because no matter what happens, and again, staying with climate for a minute, we are going to continue to see a good bit of progress on the part of the business sector. There's no doubt about that. And we've got a lot of warming baked into the system already, which means there will be more and more climate damage, and people are going to seek recompense for that damage. And we're living in a split screen world, in a sense, where we've got companies moving, making commitments, making investments, doing all sorts of good things that I think are fantastic. But it's not enough. It's not enough collectively, and companies can be on the front lines. Let me cite an example of one company that embodies this dilemma very well. BNP Paribas in 2023 had these two experiences. They were ranked at the top of the of all the big global banks in terms of their ratio of financing for clean energy versus fossil fuel energy. So number one, it was, I think their ratio is 1.4 to one clean to fossil fuel energy, best of all the big banks. They were simultaneously sued under the French law of vigilance for not doing enough to address climate change. And for me, that encapsulates the dilemmas that companies face. Those two things can both be true. They both happened, and they seem inconsistent, but actually that's the world we live in. And that's the world we're going to live in. And there will be more litigation, not less, in the coming years.
That's right, because you have emissions that are continuing to go up. To go up. I actually read Scientific American. I think I'm fully aware that there's no way we're going to hit 1.5. And I don't understand when people are just going to start really focusing on all of the work that has to be done. For example, in 80% of the low-income homes in this country that are not climate resilient, we have a housing crisis that is severe now that's going to be 10 times worse. There are just so many ramifications that are coming. And again, this is not left or right. You're a Democrat. I'm a Republican. This is neither. This is just, and it's interesting in the terminology, this is just changes in weather that are happening. This is flooding and fires that is happening. And we've got to adjust. Part of it is addressing so we reduce some of the factors that are contributing to it. Some of it is actually taking the actions to protect human life, which we are not doing it nearly enough on. But that's my two cents. Let's actually shift a little bit. I think we're going to do a deep dive for a few minutes on four of the specific areas of ESG that we think are going to be getting a lot of attention, starting with DEI. Aaron?
As you say, the legal landscape in the United States has changed, but here's what hasn't changed. What hasn't changed is America is becoming a more diverse country. You can't debate climate science. You can't debate demographics. And as the country becomes more diverse, companies have some very logical, non-ideological reasons for ensuring that their workforce, that their boards are moving in sync with that, that they think about a different set of consumer needs. Who are your customers? What are their interests? An anecdote was told to me by an insurance company. It said, we never looked at our products through the lens of gender, but then we realized that outside of our commercial lines of business, 80% of our customers are women. And women can't generalize, but women tend to have a somewhat different set of somewhat different thought process and priorities than men do. So we need to think about our products through that lens. That's not marginalizing men. That's being attuned to our marketplace. So those things are going to remain important. I also think that if you look back now, think about the tragedy of George Floyd. I think in retrospect, companies maybe said more than they were prepared to do, and that was probably a mistake. So on the one hand, aligning intention with action, it deserves more attention. And I'm not arguing for doing less, but I think maybe being a little less tied to a particular moment, that kind of thing's going to happen again. So that's the other thing I would say to companies is don't get caught unaware when the next flashpoint comes, because it's going to come. That's just, the world isn't linear, progress isn't linear, change isn't linear, events are unpredictable. And so I think being ready for the demographic change that is continuing and being aware that action has to follow words, and then and knowing that your practices will come under scrutiny at some point due to situations and events that we can't recur, but we know somehow will happen. So it was interesting in Davos last week. I attended a couple of sessions, actually more than a couple, on DEI, and every company was saying, yeah, we're not talking about it as much. We're not using the term DEI as much, but our commitment to an inclusive workplace, to thinking about our customers, think about our communities in an inclusive way, that continues unabated. And I think that's the right way to think about it.
Yeah, I agree. There are a whole bunch of new terms. There's greenwashing, but then there's green hushing, and then there's green rinsing, and then there's green crowding, blah, 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 blah. The green hushing, so what? What we are seeing is the same thing. This is the number one issue that in-house and a lot of CSOs are thinking about for 2024 being DEI, but they're not backing away from what they're doing. They're backing away from how they talk about it, which I don't think is stupid. And it goes to my friend Sylvia's question, which I'll just pose to you quickly here, Erin. BlackRock, she says about face on ESG, you know, just isn't using the term ESG and is focused on financial performance. I don't think BlackRock has actually changed from when they were focused on all of these elements as part of governance before the term ESG, which was before 2004 and now. But Erin, I'd love your perspective.
And hello, Sylvia. Thanks for the good question. I won't focus so much on BlackRock, even though they're a bit of a flashpoint, but I think more broadly, they and their peers are clearly being forced to address some of the pushback that they're getting in certain jurisdictions. And fair enough, I think the way they're getting at it by focusing on fundamentals is valuable. The shift in language, so long as the commitments remain, not a problem. I will say one of the tools that businesses have, however, is voice. And I think I would hate to see that voice go silent. I think when I think about the backlash writ large, I see four things driving it. So the first is there remains a gap between commitments and action. Number two, there are communications that whether or not they're greenwashing probably do get ahead of what companies are actually doing. Some of it's maybe not well thought through. It's not, certainly not all malevolent. Some of it is about stating ambition, but the communication is a little fuzzy and terminology is fuzzy. Those are three things that companies really do have to address. And I think BlackRock and others are trying to do that, and that's valuable. The fourth piece, though, the fourth element of the backlash is pure political point scoring. And that, in my view, I think businesses have to push back on that and call it out for what it is, which is a desire not to see an energy transition happen, not to see attention to more inclusive workplaces, not to see the diversification of boards of directors. And companies know that those things are valuable and important, and I think should call out, not be blithe about subjecting themselves to more political attacks, but I will say, I think Disney did a pretty good job after some of the kerfuffle over Don't Say Gay arose in Florida and stuck to its guns and said, this is why we think this is important. We want people at our parks to feel welcome. We don't want them to face extreme weather. That's bad for them. It's bad for Disney. It's bad for our shareholders. I think some of that remains needed. So I'll get on that soapbox a little bit and say that companies should be humble and address the shortcomings that continue to exist and probably always will, but also push back on bad faith arguments. And there are a lot of bad faith arguments.
And what, I mean, my two cents, I think one of the reasons DeSantis, that was a turning point for his campaign. And after that, things slid. It was just an interesting flashpoint. And in terms of the disingenuous arguments, my friend Jesse asks about these claims that politicians are making that focused on ESG could lead to insider trading. Disingenuous. Again, politicians, for all kinds of reasons on both sides, are looking to use ESG for all kinds of purposes. you have ESG is just so, I feel like those of us who are in the space using ESG, we do ourselves a disservice because it's so freaking broad. Cyber, having a cybersecurity policy, and now the SEC is required, it requires you to go all the way through your supply chain. Come on, you got to have good governance around that. That's not really, they're getting at DEI and climate, and they're just trying to find any way to attack policies where they think there's going to be a disconnect between focus on that policy and shareholder value. It's more of a sort of a fiduciary duty, which is why we need new corporate forms, but we're not talking about that here. That's my view. There's another question on nonprofits, which I'll come back to in a second. Just quickly highlighting the other areas. I just mentioned cyber. We're going to see a lot of focus on cyber with the new SEC rules. We're going to expect SEC enforcement. The EU cybersecurities law, new cybersecurities laws, which are going to, again, impact a lot of U.S. companies and require them to widen their scope of compliance. Cyber communications policies, hugely important, and the governance and making sure that you have a structure that allows you to ensure not just that there's compliance, but you're getting good data. The one I've been bashing ESG, I feel like the one really good use of ESG is internally to make sure everybody's talking, because we did have one client that had one division that was going out to a supplier for human rights with counsel, and another with cyber, and a different counsel over here going out to their supplier. Within a few days, one group told the supplier, I think it was they got an A+ on cyber. Great, we want to keep working with you for 20 years. And the human rights side said, you get an F, we're terminating your contract. And somebody up top at this large consumer company was like, we have got to be coordinated. What the hell's going on? Because the one thing through all of this, like scope 3 emissions, human rights, all the way through, it does impact everybody with whom you contract, not just your own operations, which is exactly what Aaron was saying before, which is why single materiality for disclosure, fine. Single materiality from a business side, from an operational, is a fool's errand, because you're going to run into issues. Aaron, you want to quickly cover off, what are we doing next? I forget. Responsible tech being a
sure
area.
Yeah, it's such a big area. I'll try to say something useful in a minute or two. Look, I think the race is on AI. There's no doubt about it. Again, going back to Davos, if you in Davos, there's a main street called the Promenade. The storefronts are taken over each year by various, mostly commercial entities. AI was dominant. You could be forgiven for walking down the street there and thinking this was an AI conference and not the World Economic Forum. There's a lot of good stuff happening, but it's moving too slowly. One example is there's a nascent collaboration that may pop out next month addressing deep fakes with respect to the elections, a collaboration between multiple tech companies, some civil society organizations, and with the aim also of getting some political parties involved. And I would say that based on what I heard, and this was Chatham House rule, but based on what I heard, both the Biden and Trump campaigns are concerned about it. Both in the last 10 days have had deep fakes arise. What does this illustrate? This illustrates the stakes. It also illustrates the fact that the technology is moving so, so fast. And Sam Altman said on the record in Davos, the advances are mind-boggling and we're going to be getting into some uncomfortable areas, I think was the essence of his quote. And it's not clear to me that governance, whether inside companies, whether inside industry coalitions, and certainly amongst regulators, is moving rapidly enough. If move fast and break things was the mantra 25 years ago in Silicon Valley, this is like strap yourself in for a trip to the moon and get ready for things to be broken. And so it's going to be a rocky ride. Some companies are doing great work, but just to further illustrate the dilemma of the pace of change, we've been working with one of our members, one of the large tech platforms, and they said to us at one point early on, we will tell you something Tuesday afternoon at 5 o'clock, present a dilemma that we'll want you to think about. And by 8 a.m. Wednesday morning, it will be different because we will learn something new about how the technology is going to work and be deployed. And so this is a massive dilemma. I guess the last thing I would say is this is not just an issue for tech companies. This is an issue for every single company. And I think companies who are not considered pure play tech companies have been a little slow. They're getting there. All of you on the phone who are not a Google or a Meta or an Amazon or a TikTok, this means you too. And we're seeing more recognition of that. I think it's really important.
And it's interesting to me, just on the responsible AI, most of the new AI companies are using new corporate forms, the PBC, nonprofit, for-profit hybrid, so that they can consider stakeholders and additional shareholders for business reasons. Just quickly on climate risk, climate emission disclosure, voluntary climate markets, there's just going to be a sea shift. I want to ask, we have two more questions. Aaron, when the private sector is looking to nonprofit partners to help them implement, has it mattered to the private sector that those nonprofits have their own ESGs or strategies? When it does, or does it not matter because they're do-gooders? That getting into you talking a little bit about transition from a business perspective, and then let's just take 1 minute each. The final question we have in the chat is about the elections. And so I know just in predictions, how this is going to impact the elections, which you should talk about. And I'll just talk about one or two things. But I will just say, there are a ton of nonprofits in the space. A lot of them have no idea. Some of them are excellent. I would say BSR is in that category. A lot of them do not know what they're doing. And I don't think you can just rely on the fact that they're nonprofits because they're doing good. But Aaron?
Yeah, we get RFPs from commercial entities. We're asked to demonstrate what we're doing on climate, on DEI, et cetera. I am proud of the fact that we have a climate goal ourselves, and I have been a little surprised at how few of our peers have one. Our emissions are not like some commercial entities, to be sure, but we are trying to take it seriously and we're dedicating resources to do that. And I think it's important. It's important for everyone to do that.
Okay, so 2024, start with the elections and corporate sovereignty versus what's happening, and especially around DEI, which was our question, but you were going to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think, Suze, we may have a future episode that is dedicated to this topic. I would say after AI, this was the topic most on people's minds in Davos last week. We convened our own session, a roundtable on what business leadership looks like in the context of the 2024 elections. It's an area that we will be working on in the year ahead. And I would say, not only in the US, but globally, don't think about it only as the process of the election. Think about what the potential aftermaths of various elections are going to be. We've been doing some scenario planning. I think it's really important. In the United States, you can anticipate some things that might happen. It is absolutely essential for business to be a part of that. There's a range of things that businesses can do. It will vary a bit on what industry sector is in, but you don't want to wake up the day after an election and find out that social division has just run down the track and is out of control. And I think that is a clear and present danger. And we are a 501c3. We are a nonpartisan organization. I am not expressing a partisan point of view. But I think political risk is not just for Nigeria and Indonesia anymore, is the way I would put it. It's for every single place a company operates. And unfortunately, elections are dividing our populations more than they are binding them right now. That is a business issue.
That's exactly right. And then I would just say, on the legal side of the coin, compliance is just going to continue, more and more regulation, more and more litigation. That's the kind of negative. On the positive, integrated in almost every deal that we are doing on the corporate side, disclosure getting more and more robust about making this real in terms of how it's measured and data and benchmarking, all of that is improving. And then a lot more creativity. I mentioned in terms of corporate form, almost every new AI company is thinking about the scaffolding, thinking about their governance, thinking about how they operate, not just taking the Valley NVCA standard and putting a stamp on it, which is great. And the financial instruments and a lot of the companies like Generate Capital and others that are really being very innovative about how they can move money to climate and really ensure that they are having a positive impact on risk and emissions. So I think that takes us to the end of our hour. Please stay tuned. We're going to have a series every month this year, where just as we did in In 2023 and 2022, we have some of the leaders in this space from an investment, from a company, and from a policy perspective come and give you their perspectives. And so stay tuned for our episode in February. And thanks to Aaron and BSR for being such a good thought partner on this.
Thank you, Suze. Thanks to the team at MOFO as well. And thanks everyone for joining.
Please make sure to subscribe to the MOFO Perspectives podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions about what you heard today or would like more information on this topic, please visit mofo.com/podcasts. Again, that's mofo, MOFO.com/podcasts.